This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we're going over I Love You, Philip Morris. So, if you haven't seen it and don't want us to ruin it for you, you may want to pass on this one and we'll catch you next time.
Hey, gentle listeners.
Are you ready
for one dry kiss? Yes, yes, you are, because you are here, and we'd love to welcome you to One Dry Kiss, our lovely, lovely.
Don't you mean hilarious?
Our reverent love letter to rom-com movies, where we cover one rom-com this month. We are doing stories that actually happened that might be a little bit light in the rom or light in the com, but were true stories. This time it's actually, I think, a pretty funny movie, and quite romantic in its own special way. I love you, Philip Morris. And I'm here with my lovely co-host, who I love so much, Corinne Edding.
And I'm here with my lovely co-host, who, yes, I would commit extra fraud for to keep her in the lifestyle to which she's become accustomed, Miss Tamara Cosio.
Then why hasn't that happened? Where is my Lambo? Where is my posh condo with an ocean view, Corinne?
That's not the lifestyle to which you've become accustomed.
Fair point. Yes. One bedroom apartments and Hondas all the way, baby. Uh-huh. That's the way I roll.
Yes.
So, Corinne, how are you doing on this lovely day today?
You know, other than sounding extra sultry because of allergies, I'm doing okay because here's the thing. I yesterday got rid of the couch that I had in my house, and in preparation for my brand spanking new couch that will be arriving, hopefully, we keep our fingers crossed, in a week and a half. I say hopefully because when I talked to the delivery people and they were setting up a date for me to come, at first I was concerned that they were just going to like arrive and I was not going to be here to receive the couch. The couch is heavy. I need people to bring it up the stairs for me. I cannot do it.
Of course.
I knew it was going to be heavy. I didn't realize how heavy it was because it's a hide-a-bed. So it has a bed in it.
That hides.
That hides. Exactly. Otherwise known as Tamara's bed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see you hide-a-bed.
When I spoke with them, they said, is there anything that we should know? And I was like, yes, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned.
As usual, yeah.
As usual, yes. No, I said, well, you know, you'll need to be buzzed in through the door. Also, I live on the second floor. And the guy totally balks. And he's like, excuse me? You live on the second floor? And I was like, yes, I live on the second floor. And he's like, oh, well, do you have an elevator? And I was like, no, I do not have an elevator. And he's like, oh, well, okay, I have you set for the date for now. And I was like, great. Feeling really secure about my delivery. And then I got a call a week later and I'm feeling slightly more secure, but also still not very confident. Where they were like, and so do you live on the second floor? And I said, yes, I do live on the second floor. Do you have an elevator? No, I do not have an elevator. Okay, well, so we're bringing the 160-pound couch up to the second floor. Yes. Yes, you are.
You think they would experience something like this previously? Seriously? I don't know that second floors have been invented recently. I imagine they've been around for quite some time. And I'm sure these gentlemen are aware that there is something called a second, a third, a fourth, and a fifth floor without elevators.
Yeah, and particularly, I was going to say particularly in California, but I would also say, like, I mean, New York has tons of, quote, walk-ups, which is, I thought was fancy until I realized, no, it just meant you had to haul your ass up a bunch of stairs. But in California, there's a bunch of apartments that don't have elevators. You just walk up an exterior set of stairs, and that's how
it
is.
Or an interior set. Yeah, there's also stairs inside that go to a second floor. They have those a lot in L.A. I am afraid to tell you, Corinne, that I will not be sleeping on your hide-a-bed because I only sleep on beds that are out, loud, and proud. I don't want my bed to be hiding. It's not my thing. You know, I want to support beds in their own unique individuality. And if they can't be out in the open, I don't want to have anything to do with them.
Okay, fine. Then you can spoon with me the next time you come visit.
That's what usually happens.
Yes.
Or you put your huge stitch in between us and we both spoon stitch and we make a stitch sandwich. It's glorious.
It's beautiful. That's the reason why I have the stitch, is just to keep mm-hmm. you extra cuddle company.
And put a protective barrier between us so I don't pummel you in my sleep.
I am not at all concerned about that. She's just concerned about me spooning up to her and saying, hugs.
Well, I am fairly hungover right now. We are recording on a Sunday morning, which is not per our usual time frame.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm not doing well, but I am pushing through. So I went to my cousin's house last night, who has a fantasy football league that Larry and I are in, and he had his awards ceremony yesterday.
Oh, did you win awards?
Larry did. Larry won a large trophy for being in second place, and I did not win anything because I sucked. And I kind of felt bad because I'm like, oh, Larry, when we first played, last season was our first season that we kind of did a joint team, and he helped me with my
picks,
draft picks and whatnot, and I got second place, almost got first, but got knocked out in the first round of the playoffs, and then we went our separate ways and had our own separate teams, and he also got second again, so he was just looking at me going, you think it was you that did so well, or do you think it was me? I'm like, shut up. But I did, I was around my two cousins, which made me think of my Aunt Connie. So I called her yesterday afternoon on a whim and we talked for like 10 minutes.
Oh, that's nice.
Was like so excited because I'm like, Tony, Alex, who are the ones that were hosting. I'm like, do you want to talk to Aunt Connie? And they're like, oh, no, we just talked to her in February when we got back from Hawaii. And I was like, well, I am horrible because I haven't talked to her in 3 years. And apparently I think everybody in my world doesn't talk to Aunt Connie but once every couple of years, when in actuality, she's getting many calls from many nieces and nephews, except for me.
Oh, well, that's OK. I don't call any of my aunts or uncles. So there you go.
Well, your aunts and uncles aren't as fabulous as Aunt Connie. Aunt Connie is the best.
Aunt Connie is pretty fantastic. However, I do visit my glorious Aunt Margaret at least once to two times a year. How often do you visit Aunt Connie?
So anyway, we're doing I Love You, Philip Morris today.
Oh, yes. Yes, we are.
Yeah. I felt super bad because I told her I was just there to visit Denise and what happened with Melody. And I was like, I'm sorry I didn't come see you, but it didn't seem like a really great time to be like, hi, I'm just going to bypass putting my dog down and come to visit you.
Yeah.
So it's almost like there's so many people now that live in that little area. It's hard to get to everybody in one visit, which makes me very sad. So next time when I don't have excruciatingly painful things to do, hopefully I can look her up and all my other friends that I missed this time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyways, on to other things, Corinne. Do you have a synopsis for I Love You, Philip Morris?
Yes, and Tamara wrote the most eloquent message to me. Can you simply synopsize this shit and make it sound smartly? And I said, oops, I did it again. I forgot to do the synopsis, but don't worry, I'll make it up real quick. Ooh, baby, baby. Here's the thing. I almost forgot to watch the movie entirely. So,
yes. Well, we had some scheduling difficulties, which is why a wrench got thrown into our system that's usually really smooth.
Yeah. Well, no, but we have a routine, you know, that we usually do. And within that routine, I have, oh, this is when I'm going to be doing this, and this is when I'm going to be doing that. And things have been off of routine. They will be for the next couple of weeks, which sometimes we got to flex to make things happen, and that's fine. However, I knew that we were recording today. And I had totally forgotten about, seeing the movie that I'd never seen before. Like, It'd be one thing if I didn't look over the script, because I trust Tamara. She does a great job. I'm not worried about it. But it's always nice to add my own little flavor in, you know. And But if worse came to worse, if I didn't zhuzh my end of the script at all, it would be fine. Because you do an awesome script. We're good.
I'm a delicious writer.
You are a delicious writer. However, haven't seen the fucking movie, so am I just going to go off of your script entirely? No. So, yeah. When Tamara was like, oh, I'm going to be sending you the link to I Love You, Philip Morris script, I was like, oh, there's something I need to be doing.
You know what you need to do for our rom-com podcast recap movie, Corinne, is you have to watch the movie.
Shocker.
I didn't think I'd have to tell you at this point in time in our recording sesh, but that is kind of an important feature that we actually watched the movie. I had a hell of a time too, because normally you're like, oh, if you give me the outline by like Wednesday morning and we usually record Wednesday night, you're like, I'm fine with that. And I'm like, all right. But due to our scheduling conflicts, I had to have it done Saturday morning. And so I was working on it all Friday night, finished it, was bleary-eyed towards the end. So I'm like, I need to go back and read this and then separate it out for the both of us, which I did in a car on the way to my cousin's during the 1.5 hour drive where I was praying to God I would not be getting car sick. And it sucked because I was using my iPad on a touch screen. And so every time we went over a bump, like I accidentally delete a paragraph and I was like, fuck. It was real, real fun. It was a real, real fun car trip.
Well, I appreciate your devotion, and I have a synopsis.
Beautiful. I know, because when you were silent for about 10 minutes and I was staring at you, I was like, are you doing, Corinne? The synopsis, because I forgot. And I'm like, uh-huh, I thought so. That is your, I'm writing the synopsis real quick because I forgot face.
All right. So, I Love You, Philip Morris, synopsis. You know how it is when you end up living a lie, get into a life or death accident, and decide to turn your life around and live in your truth? Well, I Love You, Philip Morris is just like that, except instead of Stephen, the main character played by Jim Carrey, living in his truth, he lives out many lies while finally living out and proud as a gay man and leaving his wife. However, to live the kind of lifestyle he wants, he commits fraud, more fraud, and even more fraud, which does help him meet the love of his life in prison. Philip Morris, played by Ewan McGregor, hot, hot, hottie. But what does he do after he falls in love?
Gets married.
Yay! Does he turn straight after meeting Philip Morris and they live happily ever after? Does he buy a pack of cigarettes and say, you know what, I don't need Philip Morris. I've got Philip Morris right here in my hands. Or does he end up pirating a cruise ship for the two of them to live out the rest of their days? Or something else? Keep those listening ears listening to find out. Well, Tamara, are you ready to get us launched on the beginning of I Love You, Philip Morris's story?
Yes, yes, I am. This is my movie choice and I stand behind it. We open on a sunny sky full of clouds and the credits tell us that this really happened. We cut to adult Stephen, laying in a hospital bed, emaciated, sickly, seemingly on death's door. His voiceover explains, people do crazy things for love. Matter of fact, that's why I'm laying here dying, because of love. And then we flash back to Stephen's childhood, where he's about 8 years old lying in the grass, finding shapes and animals and dicks in the clouds with his friends. When his parents call him inside, he sits across from his bespectacled mother, father, and sibling, who he doesn't bear a strong resemblance to, as Steve has no glasses and very light hair, and they tell him he's adopted. Young Stephen looks dumbfounded as his father explains, we chose you and you're so special, and that's why we gave your mom a brown paper bag full of money in the hospital parking lot so we could take you home.
That's not what you want to hear.
Yeah, like a shifty fly-by-night interaction involving a brown paper bag full of money is not how I want to hear my adoption story.
Right, and I wonder, like, were they just waiting out in the hospital parking lot with a bag of money looking for a woman without her husband to come walking by with a newborn?
Yeah.
Being like, we got money. Shaking the
paper bag. The bag of cash, like kibble to your cat, like, hey, you want some of this?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Poor Stephen. But Adult Stephen tells us, I didn't let that little bit of information get me down. I decided to be the best son. No, the best person I could be. Mm. And we cut to him some years later, where we get a glimpse into Stephen's life as a young man, where he enthusiastically plays organ in his church, then happily greets coworkers at his job as a policeman, and finally at home tucking in his 7-ish-year-old daughter before getting on his knees and praying with his wife, Debbie.
Oof.
And Debbie is thanking Jesus for everything from coffee filters to her daughter's clean allergy test.
Everything. I was like, lady, yeah, you need to stop with the prayers and just crawl into bed because I'm getting tired just listening to you.
Yes. She was like, Stephen also in the scene, he kept trying to get up when she said like her prayers and then she kept going and he's like, oh shit, okay. And he'd get back down on his knees and then he thinks she was done. And oh no, she needs to thank Jesus for those coffee filters. And oh no, we need to thank Jesus for finding the peanut butter. Oh no, we got to thank Jesus for that allergy test. I was like, I think Jesus at that point would be like, no, no, it's good. Okay,
it's thanks. Good. Yeah.
Yeah, we're good. We're good, Deb. Yeah. But after boisterous praying, what does a young married couple do but have boisterous sex?
But is it, though? I mean, he's kind of just jackhammering her while she lies there, corpse-like. I was like, this just doesn't seem like very much fun for either of them.
I know. And it's not, because as he is ramming into her, he inexplicably stops and asks out of nowhere, should I use my police connections to find my birth mother? Debbie is understandably confused and tells him that he should really think about it, but maybe not at this exact moment, because she's so enjoying their boisterous lovemaking currency. Mm-hmm. He brought her out of the moment. But Stephen has thought about it a lot and already has a box of information downstairs with his mom's name on it. Debbie's surprised but excited and tells him they should go downstairs and look through it. And Steve, exasperated, tells her, oh, God, Deb, I have to finish first. Yeah. So he continues ramming into her. But eventually they do get downstairs and excitedly drink big glasses of milk as they rifle through the paperwork. Yeah. Stephen opens up a folder and realizes his mother lives in the same town as them. Debbie is so thrilled that she decides she needs to bake some cookies. I want to bake some cookies. You want to bake some cookies? Let's bake some cookies.
Or you could have had milk instead. You want to get some milk? We should have some milk. You know, it'd be exciting to have some milk. Mm.
No, no, I am not a milk drinker.
Neither
milk kind of grosses me out.
Yeah, same.
In cereal, yes.
Mm-hmm.
As a cooking ingredient, yes. By itself in a big ass glass after boisterous sex, no thank you.
You and Larry. Just laying in bed with your cups of milk.
No.
After the cookie extravaganza, milk drinking, and maybe some secret twisted teas, who knows? We cut to Stephen walking up to a ranch-style house. House. The doormat says, welcome. And once again, we're looking at a slice of Norman Rockwell life. Just like Stephen has been cultivating with his wife, the perfect family home. His voiceover tells us that the only reason he became a police officer was to find his mother. So this was the plan all along. He knocks on the door and an elderly lady answers. There's a birthday party going on behind her and Stephen asks, are you Barbara Bascom? The lady responds, yes. And Stephen quickly informs her, I'm your long lost son that you gave up for adoption years ago. A flash of recognition passes across her face, but Barbara wants none of this and slams the door in his face, declaring, I have no idea what you're talking about, Stephen. Except he never told her his name. Ooh, moated. You're moated, mama.
Oh, my God. I haven't heard that in so long. Moated, corroded, your butt exploded. Oh, my God.
Oh.
You just took me back to middle school. Thank you, Corinne.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Stephen is heartbroken and begins yelling through the door. How could you give me up? What was wrong with me? Why did you give me away and keep your other two? I was the middle child, for God's sakes. That would definitely give me a complex. Being like, yes, the middle child being given up? Yeah.
You know, Barbara Bascom heard that siren song of some shaking cash in a bag and just couldn't help herself.
Ooh.
Perhaps he was the product of an affair.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking that Stephen's mom had one child out of wedlock, two child out of wedlock, and then third child was married, but she couldn't support second child, so she gave Stephen up for adoption. That's my conjecture.
Or possibly she just played a really fucked up game of Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe, and he lost.
That's true. Well, nobody was shaking a bag of cash for her older son, so.
So Steven should be proud of that. Uh-huh. Like, nobody wanted to buy you. Somebody wanted to buy me.
Exactly. Steven hears faint voices singing, "Happy Birthday," and angrily takes the welcome doormat under his arm, yelling behind him, "This is a lie, so I'm taking it with me." His voiceover adds, "I quit the force that day and I moved to Texas." The next flashback, shows him having an afternoon barbecue, meeting his new neighbors, telling them about his job at Cisco Produce, and then later in the evening, fucking a man in the ass. And the man fucking is a reveal. So at first you see him humping, and I was like, the way he is humping is not the jackhammer action devoid of all sentiment that he was doing before. I think there's a man under those cheeks. And I was right.
Oh, I was thinking just him and Debbie were spicing it up when I first watched it. So when it panned down, I was like, that is a mustachioed man. Wow.
His voiceover chimes in, "Did I forget to mention that I'm gay?" He tries to rationalize it to us by saying, "It's just like shaving off a small slice of a puzzle piece to make it fit. Sometimes I told Debbie I was entertaining clients or working late, but things have a way of coming into the light." Oh. We cut to Steven driving his sporty convertible down a dark street when he gets T-boned by a speeding car. The accident is bad, and the near-death experience causes Steven to have a revelation.
Revelation. Revelation. Revelation.
While the EMTs are loading him onto a stretcher, he confesses to them, "I'm not going to live my life as a lie anymore. I'm going to do what I want, and I'm going to fuck who I want. I'm going to be the biggest faggot. Faggot! I'm a fag!" The EMTs are nonplussed at the situation. They just want him to chill the fuck out so they can get him to the hospital. But from this moment on, Steven is determined to live his life in truth. So he wastes no time and tells a flabbergasted Debbie later on that night in the hospital room that he's gay.
I would be telling that story till the day I die if I was an EMT. Some guy got in a car accident, and after we were putting him into the ambulance, he was screaming that he's a faggot and he's going to live his best life now. Good for him.
Yes. And just gentle listeners, just to let you know, faggot was the word used in the movie.
Right. Steven said it. We are not in, like, inserting it. Yes. Thank you for clarifying that, because I did not point that out in the outline that Steven said the F word.
You do point out a word, I think, later, but but not this one. Yeah.
Okay. Not here. But yes, Steven said it. That was what was said.
Yeah.
Ah. And we see Steven living in his truth in the next scene. A much tanner, silk-shirted Steven is walking two miniature pinchers down a Miami street with his muy caliente.
Did you notice the giant tiger golden belt buckle that he had on, too?
No, I did not.
I mean, it was glorious. Wait, I took a screenshot of this bad boy.
Oh, shut up. Did you really?
Here we go. It is growling and it is ready for action. I am sending it your way.
Oh. Wow. That is the gift that keeps on giving right there.
I mean, it's not everyone who can rock a giant golden tiger, excuse me, probably gold tiger belt buckle.
So are you shooting me hints for Christmas gifts this year, Corinne?
You know, as long as it's solid gold so I can melt it down and then pay for a really nice vacation for us. Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. So you don't get a solid gold belt buckle in the shape of a tiger that's protecting your punani. Because that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
It looks like it is a penis and punani, if you're a woman, protector. Which, I don't know. Kind of digging.
Okay. Note to self. Your birthday's coming up. Got it.
Anyways, Steve and his belt buckle are walking down the street with his muy caliente boyfriend, Jimmy, played by Rodrigo Santoro. Steven's voiceover.
He is very hot.
Yes. Informs us that in his new life, he bought anything that tickled his fancy, was the go-to guy if anyone wanted to know the newest hot spot, and sometimes he stayed at posh hotels because he heard that great bathrooms are cute bellboys. But living the gay lifestyle was expensive, and to supplement his income, Steven turned into a con man. He staged slips and falls in grocery stores, threw himself down escalators in department stores, and committed credit card fraud. Mm. We see him around Christmas time using a fake ID and credit card to buy Jimmy a gold Rolex watch. Come Christmas Day, he presents his beau with the watch, and Jimmy is taken aback by the gift, but doesn't seem entirely thrilled about it. Steven asks him, what's wrong? And Jimmy seems reluctant to say. Steven asks, is it the color? It's the gold, right? Jimmy's about to confirm this until Steven flings a second watch box at him and says, I know, that's why I got you the sterling silver one. The gold is mine. Jimmy's charmed by the ruse, and we soon learn that Steven's extravagant lifestyle is not solely spent on his boyfriend, as later that day, he's phoning his ex-wife Deb to wish her and his daughter a Merry Christmas. And their relationship seems amicable, but Debbie's less than enthused with her Christmas gift from him, which looks to be a big bag full of money, which I would happily take, Deb. Just saying.
I know. I'm like, you are raising that child on your own. Take the money. Take the money and run. It's cash. It's not traceable. It can't be. Take it.
Although, Debbie, you know how she's a devout Jesus follower.
Yes.
She probably knows that the money was acquired by questionable means.
Yes.
Because she whispers hurriedly into the phone, this is not what the Lord wants, Stephen. As their daughter opens her gift from Dad, which is also a couple of more stacks of money.
Yeah.
Yay! But this doesn't go on for long. A short while later, Stephen walks into his job at Cisco, and the receptionist tells him that he has some visitors. This makes him nervous, especially after he passes his frosted glass office door and can visibly see police officers standing behind it. He doesn't stop. Instead, he heads straight to the elevator and then home, where there's even more police officers surrounding his apartment.
Oh, Stephen. You shiesty as fuck motherfucker. Jesus Christ, Stephen.
I just have to say that my one favorite part of this movie that I haven't mentioned, I don't think anywhere in the outline, or I did in the very, very end, is I love the soundtrack of this movie, and the song that plays throughout it at various times is I Cried Like a Little Boy by Devotchka, I think it is.
I was wondering why you mentioned that. I had no idea what that song was. I didn't recognize it at all. And if you had told me it was playing throughout the entire movie, I would have told you you were lying, except I believe you 100%.
It's so funny because it'll just be like a really traumatic or serious scene and you hear dweedy dweedy. It's just like that. Now every time I hear that song, I automatically think of I Love You Philip Morris, and it is strategically placed in the most delightful sections of this movie. Okay, I'm done. Go ahead.
Steven's voiceover tells us, I was a cop, so I knew what prison was like, and I could not go to jail. We cut to him in an abandoned lot, sitting in his car, trying to choke down a handful of pills with a giant Costco-sized bottle of vodka. But it's not a successful suicide attempt. It's actually rather anticlimactic, as the only thing he accomplishes is falling asleep at the wheel while driving and slowly rolling to a stop on the median and getting taken to the hospital, probably only because he fell forward and was hitting the car horn with his head, so it brought some attention. Otherwise, I bet people just would have ignored the car.
Yeah.
When Steven finally comes to, Jimmy's there, and so is Debbie and the police. Jimmy asked, why didn't you tell me, Steven? And Steven responds with a non-answer, I can't go to jail. I just can't. Jimmy, who didn't know about the fraud until then, says, we'll just take things one step at a time. Jimmy leaves to inform the cops that Steven's awake, and Steven takes the one step at a time comment literally and puts on his pants and tries to sneak out of the hospital room with the subtlety of a cartoon character. There's practically doink, 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 doink noises accompanying his footsteps. He's still heavily sedated and not very good at sneaking. Debbie sees him staggering down the hall, and she, Jimmy, and the cops chase Stephen through the halls and up to the rooftop, where in a panic, he tries to jump into a dumpster. He throws his shoes in there first. He got that in there, but he misses and lands flat on the asphalt two stories down. He doesn't die, though, but he does finally get sent to jail. We cut to him wearing a yellow prison jumpsuit and getting catcalled by hardened criminals as he enters jail. But Stephen, well, he's a survivor, and he acclimates quickly. I think probably due to blowjobs.
Yeah. I cut a whole scene out where he's basically showing around a new prisoner that he's sharing a cell with. And he's like, this is how things run. You can either pay people money, get beat up, or give them a blowjob. Yeah. It's your choice. And in between blowjobs, Stephen is making a call to Debbie and his daughter as a prison fight breaks out in the adjoining room. In the midst of the chaos, he sees a petite man with blue eyes and blonde hair carefully make his way past the violence and slip out the door unnoticed. Stephen has hearts in his eyes and makes it his business to find out who that man is.
Ooh.
It's only a short while later that Stephen finds that same man in the jail's law library and assists him in grabbing a book off a high shelf. Stephen lies, as he's wont to do, and tells the blonde that he was an attorney on the outside and asks if the civil law book he was reaching for was because he wants to sue somebody. The soft-spoken man admits that, I'm just trying to help a friend. I met in jail. He's sick with AIDS, and he's trying to see if I can get him some help. Stephen immediately jumps to the rescue and informs him that he can get him in touch with the Prison Rights Committee. They do that sort of work pro bono and offers him the number. The man in turn offers his thanks and a handshake and introduces himself as Philip Morris. The name of the movie.
Ooh. And who do we love? Who do we love?
Philip Morris?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes. Philip Morris. Let me say it with more conviction. We love Philip Morris. Yeah. I love you, Philip Morris.
Yes. I love you, Philip Morris.
Stephen introduces himself and asks, why haven't I seen you in the prison yard? And Philip admits, I don't go in the prison yard. You know what happens to blonde-haired, blue-eyed queer boys out there. Stephen does and adds that Philip doesn't look like he belongs in prison. Philip agrees. He just happened to, you know, rent a car and keep it a little too long, so.
Poor Philip Morris. The whole time, while they're in the library, Philip's talking. Stephen seems to be getting more and more enamored. They find a semi-private corner of the law library and get to know each other. Winky, winky. But really, not that way.
Not that way.
No. They talk and laugh and piss off the other library patrons by getting too loud. They're hitting it off like gangbusters. And Stephen says solemnly, I can't wait to tell my daughter about you. I can tell her that I finally found a good friend. Philip sadly divulges, yeah, but I'm getting transferred tomorrow to another section of the prison. But Stephen's not ready to let go. He grabs Philip's hand and says, don't worry. This right here is destiny. I love the law and I've been around, but this feeling is real. There's about 6,000 volts shooting across the table here. Philip responds guardedly, you're coming on a little strong. But Stephen assures him, I'm the real deal. Just give me a chance. The next day, we see Philip cautiously entering his new prison cell. He barely puts his bedding down when the block prisoner custodian named Clavon rolls his mop bucket over to his door and growls, you Philip? Philip nods and Clavon flings a folded up piece of paper at him. It's a letter from Stephen sent through the prison mail system. And we get a montage of their relationship growing through dozens of letters passed from prisoner to prisoner and cell block to cell block. Stephen writes Philip and Philip writes back until one fateful day. Philip is at his door begging Clavon to stop mopping the floor. Give me my letter, Clavon snarls. I ain't your DHL, motherfucker. You got a tracking number? Philip cries, but it's been 3 days and I haven't heard from Stephen. Stephen's letters have inexplicably stopped. Does Stephen not love Philip anymore? Has he decided to transfer his love of Philip Morris to Philip Morris Marlboro cigarettes? Philip lies in his bunk, pondering this, wondering what he did wrong and why he isn't a pack of cigarettes when his cell door opens. And there stands Stephen, the con man, finagled a transfer, and Philip is thrilled. He asks, "How'd you do this?" And Steven smiles mischievously and says, "I know a guy." Then he takes Philip's face in his hands and says, "Don't worry, I'll take care of everything from now on." Philip now has hearts in his eyes, and he gazes at his reunited love momentarily before saying, much to Corinne's surprise, that's me, "Enough with the romance, let's fuck." His quiet demeanor disappears as he pounces on Stephen in a sexual way this time.
After their boisterous lovemaking, the couple are snuggling on the bottom bunk, talking when an ear-piercing shriek breaks the silence. Philip tells his beau, "Ugh, that's the shrieker. He does that every night. I barely get a wink of sleep." We cut to the next day in the prison hallway. Philip sees the shrieker getting pummeled by a large-fisted man who tells him, "Shut the fuck up!" between punches. Philip asks his jail neighbor, "Why is that guy kicking the shrieker's ass? He's not even on our cell block." And the neighbor answers matter-of-factly, "Oh, somebody probably paid him." Philip seems incensed and hurries back to his cell and confronts Stephen, who's lounging on the bottom bunk. Philip demands, "Did you pay to get the shrieker beat up?" Stephen feigns innocence, but when Philip gets more agitated, he finally comes clean and says, "Yes, I paid for him to get beat up, but you hate that guy." Philip's icy persona melts away as he rushes into Stephen's arms, sobbing, "Oh, that is the nicest thing anyone's ever done for me. I love you so much."
And you know, it's occurring to me, because I was wondering about Stephen and the kind of scams he was working to get his ways. And it occurred to me, you know what? I think he is just like master level blowjob giver. I think he was just like, "No, I don't have money, but just you wait. I will blow your mind."
You know what else blows my mind? All the montages in this damn movie. Because we get another montage of their prison romance. They bribe Cleavon to play "Chances Are" by Johnny Mathis on a hidden stereo system and dance into the night. Or at least until the prison guards beat the shit out of Cleavon for breaking curfew rules. They snuggle while watching a black and white flick in the movie room as another inmate in front of them jacks off enthusiastically.
Oh, missed that part. Hey.
Yeah. They're like, the camera pans over and they're lovingly like shoulder to shoulder. And Philip has his head leaning on Stephen's chest. And right in front of him, there's some guy that's like, like just going at his dick while watching a black and white movie that's not in any shape, way, or form sexual. So
thank you, Hayes Act. Yes.
Yeah. Get it where you can. Stephen also sneaks surf and turf into the cafeteria for dinner instead of the standard prison slop. But the honeymoon is short-lived when somebody rats Stephen out about his hit on the shrieker. We next see two guards coming to drag Stephen away. He's getting transferred. He gets cuffed and led through the prison to an awaiting bus. Philip doesn't even get to say goodbye, so he runs through the prison while the song, "You don't know what it's like, baby, you don't know what it's like to love somebody, to love somebody the way I love you." Ooh. Again, that soundtrack masterfully placed. Chef's kiss. Philip even goes into the dangerous prison yard where he finds the fence closest to the transferring prisoners, sees Stephen in the crowd and screams, "I love you!" before he's loaded up. Stephen hears his cries and is touched that Philip braved the yard to say goodbye and yells back, "I love you, Philip Morris. We'll be together soon."
And I have no doubt about that because Stephen's a wily one.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen's voiceover tells us, "Those were the three longest months of my life, and I was determined to get us back together as soon as possible." We see Stephen getting released from prison and getting into a cab. He directs the prisoner. He directs the prisoner.
Who also escaped and stole a cab, apparently.
Woo! Directs the driver to take him to a thrift store and ultimately exits the cab at Philip's prison. But now he's donning a suit. Stephen goes inside as a visitor and finally sees Philip in the flesh, albeit through a thick glass partition, talking on telephones on either side. Stephen tells him, "I got a lot of work to do, honey. I'm getting you released early. I got a hearing in the morning and motions to file. Philip, you are the sweetest and most gentle man I've ever known, and I know people have taken advantage of that, but I want to protect you." Philip looks touched and professes his love for Stephen and ends the conversation by smiling and saying, "Get me out of here." We next see Stephen at his desk yelling into a phone, insisting that the motion was filed and presented to a DA, and he demands action be taken before slamming the phone down. When the camera pans out, we see that he's not in the law office, but working behind a deli counter, where he puts on an apron and tells a waiting customer, "My boyfriend's getting out of prison next week." Stephen's ruse works because we see him at the jail presenting a prison guard with an early release order for one Philip Morris. The guard asks who Stephen is to the prisoner, and he says flatly, "I'm his attorney." The guard doesn't question it, because who would be ballsy enough to pretend to be an attorney? Releases the prisoner, but looks confused when the two are reunited because it feels so good. Because Philip jumps into Stephen's arms, wraps his legs around his waist, and they spin around in a happy circle. Which doesn't seem to be the typical attorney-client relationship. But, you know, that's just me.
Maybe they have some sort of alternate way of paying, you know?
Yeah. Winky, yeah. Winky. But Stephen gets away with it. And now Philip thinks he's a gifted lawyer that can get anybody out of anything. He's a gifted something. Jesus Christ, this fucking asshole. Fuck all.
Oh, my God. And it just gets better from there, gentle listeners. Ugh. If you think, yes, that is just the first in the Philip Morris conning the jail system story.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, and Philip thinks that Stephen is a gifted lawyer that can get anybody out of anything. And this is evident when the couple have a homecoming party and Philip introduces Stephen to his old neighbor, Eudora Mixon. Philip asks Stephen to represent her because she owns a building and is just having a terrible time with a contractor who gave her shit plans on some work and is now suing for payment. Philip looks at Stephen expectantly as Eudora regales her legal woes, and he hesitates only a moment before accepting, saying, "Why, litigation is my specialty." Eudora's face falls momentarily as she asks, "Can you still practice law after being in jail?" Stephen assures her that he can, and she enthusiastically agrees to hire him, adding, "I'll pay your regular rate. I just really want somebody I can trust." We cut to him days later, jogging into a courthouse to meet her. Stephen apologizes for being late and holds up his briefcase, explaining, "I got held up in another case. Sorry." They go up into the courtroom together, and Stephen seems to know exactly what he's doing. He gives some good, solid arguments about Eudora's lack of payment, but the defense easily pokes holes in his case, and then they say the magic words, "breach of contract." The judge seems to be siding with the defense, and as a Hail Mary, Stephen... We'll find out what he does after this break.
Ooh.
What's this Hail Mary, Corinne? What do you think he does? Do you have any educated guesses, even though you've seen the movie? So just for a second, pretend that you haven't.
Oh, no. I am 100% pretending that I haven't. Okay. His Hail Mary is he fakes a heart attack on the courtroom floor.
Ah.
Yeah.
Ah.
Uh-huh.
But that wouldn't help Eudora in the long run. He actually does something more conniving.
Mm.
Shocking, I know. Stephen demands to see the judge in his chambers, which the judge allows. And a short while later, Stephen, the suing attorney, and the judge are in his private chambers. And Stephen dives into a monologue about, "I'm a modest man and I didn't go to Yale. I went to a small school and grew up on a small farm." Stephen then pointedly takes off his fake pair of glasses and adds, "I passed the same bar exam as my colleague here and I will not let him push around that humble woman." The judge appreciates his passion and responds, "Point taken, but where are you going with this?" Stephen, out of options, looks at the judge and says, "I think you know where I'm going with this." Him, the judge, and the other attorney sit there for a few uncomfortable minutes before the judge asks, "Do you mean Marshall versus Chow?" The suing attorney recognizes this case that they're referring to and grumbles, "Oh, shit." Stephen's face lights up and he agrees enthusiastically, "Your Honor, that is exactly what I'm talking about." And we cut to him and Eudora celebrating because by some miracle he won the case, even though he definitely is not an attorney, has never passed the bar exam, and the only court experience he had before this day was on the criminal side of the bench.
Mm-hmm. And reading books in the law library, mm-hmm. which he did do a lot of.
Yes, but it also is just so surprising, like... If you go into a court and pretend to be an attorney, like, who checks their credentials? Like, honestly, like, what does that process look like? And how easy would it be for somebody to pretend? Well, I mean, you could represent yourself, I guess. So,
yeah,
you don't have to be a practicing attorney, question mark?
I think the big problem comes when you represent yourself as an attorney when you are not legally an attorney. Yes.
But there doesn't seem to be any checks and balances to seek that sort of thing out.
We do. We see those checks and balances in My Cousin Vinny.
Ah.
Yeah. And I bet there's even more checks and balances now because people can just be like, clickety, 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 clickety. I love how your talk to text changed the name Eudora to Endora.
Yes, I noticed that the last couple times, and I'm like, it's not Endora, it's Eudora. Fuck you, autocorrect. God damn it.
It's like, and Bewitched, is that the...
Yes, mother-in-law, I think.
Yeah, it's the mother-in-law, yes. Good times.
And gentle listeners, the the Bewitched mother-in-law is not in this movie. So.
No, no. But if she was, it would be a delight. I think it would just add to the movie entirely. Her and her mischievous witchcraft.
And her blue eyeshadow, her very, very blue eyeshadow.
Her very, very blue eyeshadow and her very, very red hair. Yes. And then she and Steven could make a power team together.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that movie just practically writes itself.
It does. With Eudora's infusion of cash, Steven surprises Philip with a luxury condo. Philip is delighted, but asks apprehensively, can we afford this? And Steven assures him they can. And to prove it, he adds, but first, we're going on a vacation to Key West. Woo! And they do. We see them giving each other blowies on a fishing boat, having wine on the beach, and kissing while the sun sets. Not in the sunset. That was Tamara. Steven's voiceover tells us, with Philip, I felt invincible, and I promised myself that he would never want for anything ever again. That meant I needed a real job and no more scams. Really? But really? We cut to Steven, who's in a fancy high-rise office for an interview. In walks Dan Lindholm, a CEO in a business suit.
Corinne, your accent is bleeding into your outline. And it is adorable.
I went on a date the other day, and at some point, I started talking. Oh my gosh, it was so embarrassing. I started talking in some kind of an accent, and he's like, are you from the South? I was like, oh no, no. I'm sorry, Southerners. I don't think I'm Southern. I don't think I have a Southern accent. Steven does what he does best and sweet talks Dan about the space memorabilia that's on his office walls. Lindholm is friendly but unreadable until they sit down. Lindholm shares, I didn't know what to make of your resume at first, but your qualifications were leaps and bounds above the competition. 2-time employee of the year at Prudential? Oh no, he's not running any kind of scam with this. No, not Steven. He's not running a scam to get a job. No.
Absolutely not.
Nuh-uh. 2-time employee of the year at Prudential, I think he misspelled prison, and software creator at IBM. It must have been an autocorrect thing. We get a montage of Steven before the interview, fielding calls from Lindholm's office and acting as the referral contacts on his faux reference list. We cut to Steven after the interview in his posh corner office with a view. He got the job. Then he's at a quarterly meeting where we think he's going to shit the bed. But instead, he presents quarterly earnings that far surpass his predecessor. How does he do it? Through a bar graph. That's how he does it. Is that bar graph accurate? Don't really think so. Although, it might be because of the scam. I mean, he's so totally legit now that he reveals he's
going on the straight and narrow, Corinne. He said so before.
Uh-huh, yeah.
No more cunning.
We can trust Steven. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We don't know how he did it, but he begins winning over the office veterans. Oh, wait. Yes, we do. He's a con man. Even Dan Lindholm pops his head in Steven's office and invites him to play golf. Steven has never played golf before, but he's not going to tell his boss no. We see him the next weekend schlepping clubs across the living room, much to Philip's chagrin. He tells Steven, golf? But you're a homosexual. You might as well eat pussy. You know you can tell them you're gay. They can't fire you. Steven is undeterred and huffs back. It's for work. And he has no intention of divulging his sexual preferences because we next see Stephen at a work gala, sans Philip. Seriously, he goes up to his partner and he's in a fucking tuxedo and like Stephen's there fucking doing the dishes and he's like, oh, you're dressed up. And he's like, it's just a little work thing. Don't you worry about a thing. And I'm like, oh, really? I know you say you're devoted to Stephen, but I saw the person that you replaced the admin assistant with who refused to get you coffee. And he looked very gay. And I'm just wondering if there's a little action going on there on the side. Like, I'm like, I think that Philip is Stephen's one and only true love. But I don't necessarily think he's his one and only lover. So Stephen goes to the work gala, sans Philip, who doesn't say it but looks like a wounded puppy dog when Stephen leaves and is like, don't worry, I'll be back very soon. I'm going to cut things short. Mm. That's super consolation. Thanks. And when two of his colleagues' wives ask him if he's married, Stephen says, no, but I'm engaged. The ladies look around. Well, where is she then, honey? Stephen doesn't correct them and instead answers, she works.
Dun, dun, dun. But it's not long before Stephen's back to his old ways. His voiceover tells us, maybe it was my nature, or maybe it was my past, or maybe it was because they were the most boring fucking people in my life. But whatever the reason, I had been robbing them blind for months. Mm-hmm. We get another montage of Stephen's con, which boils down to him taking the HMO money, which is millions at any given time, that's waiting to get sent to the doctors. And while it's just laying there idly, Stephen puts it into a high-yield bank account to gather interest for the short amount of time that they have it. And of course, he takes a nominal fee of 50% for his trouble.
Okay, which explains how the bar graph can be higher, because he's actually, theoretically, if he's only taking 50%, still making the millions more than they were before. So this is the one scam that I kind of approve of.
Yes.
Because he's taking a chunk of the money, but he's the one that created the advantage and he's giving them money too. It's mutual. This, what's it called when something is leeching off of another thing? A parasite. Stephen in his parasitic ways is actually still helping the company he's working for.
Although I am fairly sure that that is illegal.
Yes, it is.
Yes, yes, yeah. We next see him and Philip living the life Stephen thinks they deserve. They're moving into a McMansion, driving matching Benzes with personalized vanity plates. I think it says Stephen 1 and Philip 1. And Philip is slightly suspicious and asks, how big was that Christmas bonus anyway? Stephen admits it was pretty substantial. And Philip adds, but in July? But his queries are quickly silenced when their matching jet skis arrive, also with personalized vanity plates. Stephen's new flashy lifestyle isn't escaping his coworkers' attention either.
I just want to point out that fucking Philip was like, what do we need with jet skis? Why do we have fucking jet skis?
Oh, but see, that's part of the ruse. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Look at the jet skis.
I think that Philip would have been okay with, I mean, as much as living a lavish life is lovely, I think he would have been okay with living a more modest life and having his love with him more. Personally.
But is that what Stephen wants? See?
No.
No, it's not. Stephen's coworker, Larry, which I just have to pause for a moment and say that my life has been filled with many Larrys this last couple of days, because not only was there a Larry, which is not a common name, in my opinion, that I hear very often, except for my guy that's in the other room named Larry. I haven't heard Larry. I haven't seen the name Larry, but there's my Larry. There's the Larry that we're referring to in the outline. And then last night at the party, my cousin's best friend came and his name was also Larry. The Larry Palooza.
One of the guys in my dad's band, the Golden State Ramblers, his name is Larry, but I wouldn't expect you to know that.
Oh, yeah, Larry. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when me and Larry met on OKCupid years back, I'm like, Do you by chance, are you part of a band named the Golden Skeins? And he said, sadly, no. And I was like, okay, good. Because then you'd be like probably way older than me. Yes. And in a band with Corinne's dad.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there. Thank you for coming to my Larry talk. Anyways, Larry, a company accountant, notices Steve's new Mercedes one day in the parking garage and compliments Steven on it. When Steven starts acting squirrely, Larry decides to do some digging. Mm. At home, Philip is also getting nagged by suspicions. One morning, while watering plants in their very expansive backyard that could be a golf course, I couldn't tell because it looked like their backyard contained acreages. And sometimes if you have the houses that are butt up against a golf course, then you don't have a surrounding fence. So I was very confused by that. Philip tells Stephen about something he read in a gossip magazine. A criminal was thwarted by the cops because they find out everything. Stephen can read between those very wide lines and asks, is there something you want to ask me, Philip? Philip rushes over to Steve, grateful for the opening, and asks, is something going on? Something you're not telling me? Because if there is, I want you to stop right now. Stephen looks at Philip deep in his eyes and lies through his teeth, saying, there's nothing going on, I promise you. Philip assures him, because I don't care about the money. I just want you. I want us to be together. Stephen says, we'll always be together. And there's nothing going on, baby. I would never lie to you. Mm. And this seems to ease Philip's mind. Sucker.
Mm. I would never lie to you. You're lying by saying I'd never lie to you. Mm. No. But Stephen feels the noose tightening around him. He senses a disturbance in the Stephen force. The next day at work, he has a sneaking suspicion. He goes into Larry's office before anyone arrives and starts sniffing around. He sees an appointment with the sheriff's department written in his planner and resorts to some spy shit. You know, the spy shit that we learned in like fifth grade by either watching... Well, for us, it probably would have been 3-2-1 contact. And for people who are younger, Ghost Rider or even younger, who knows what. But yes. Hey.
Spy shit. Spy shit, I say.
Spy shit. Spy shit. By lightly running a pencil across the page, which reveals an indentation of the last thing Larry wrote. It reads, 800, 300, how do you say that?
837,502.12.
Thank you. I'm not going to try it. I'm going to take Tamara's word, which sounds perfect, which is the exact amount Stephen has in his secret embezzling bank account.
Why did I tell you? I would have liked to have like 3 or 4 more attempts by you.
We get another montage of Stephen panicking, pulling wads of cash from every ATM. Why doesn't he just go to the bank? I'm curious, and just pull out a chunk.
Because they might have, I don't know, like...
He couldn't have pulled out all $800,000 of it. That wouldn't have worked. Oh. But he certainly pulled out a chunk of change.
Right.
So he's pulling out wads of cash from every ATM he comes across while Philip floats worry-free in their swimming pool. Then Stephen calls Deb, and after a few short pleasantries, like Deb remarking, Stephen, you wouldn't believe your daughter, and she's definitely takes after you. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Is she a con artist, too? Stephen playfully asks, why, is she already chasing boys? Debbie gives a sarcastic laugh, and he nonchalantly tells her, gonna be changing all my numbers and contact information. Cool. Nothing to see here. Debbie, unfazed, asked, you going on the lam again? Stephen doesn't lie, instead saying, nobody knows me like you, Deb. Fucker. In between bites of snacks, Deb tells him casually, you really should stop doing this. You're such a good man, and Jesus has a plan for you. Is he? But is he, though? Is he a good man? Stephen agrees, placating her until his phone beeps, and he jokingly says, oops, that must be Jesus on the other line. I gotta go. But it's not Jesus. It's Stephen's boss, Dan, who casually, not casually, asks, hey, Stephen, so where are you? Coming in anytime soon? Stephen flatly responds, No, Dan, I'm not coming back. I think we both know why, and hangs up. Stephen races home, only to find an angry Philip sitting on the couch in their palatial living room with his arms crossed. He accuses, people have been calling all morning. What's going on? As, like, cash flutters everywhere from Stephen, like, out of his pockets, out of, like, it's just like a money trail. Like, they don't even need to, like, wonder where Stephen is because they can just follow the trail of money from the ATM all the way to his fucking house.
That confetti.
Stephen pulls wads of cash out of his pockets and says, while panting, nothing. I just thought we could go on a little vacation to Key West. Let's pack quick. When Philip doesn't move, Stephen throws the remaining cash onto the floor and hurriedly races up the stairs, exclaiming, that's okay. I'll pack for you. Mm-hmm. Way to read the room, Stephen. Way to read the room. This is all Philip needs, and he bolts up screaming, I fucking knew it. Stephen rushes around the second floor while trying to loudly assure Philip, everything is going to be okay. But when he stops long enough to look downstairs, he realizes that Philip is gone.
Stephen runs to the front door only to see Philip screeching away in his Mercedes. He cries a defeated plea to no one, Philip! Well, he goes back into the foyer and crams wads of cash into his suitcase. He murmurs beseechingly, you gotta trust me, before running into the driveway and slinging the case into the backseat of his convertible. And many, many money bills comically waft around, as Corinne stated before, because it's goddamn nearly a cartoon scene. Mm-hmm. As a group of cop cars speed in and surround his car, Stephen is irate and he hurls curse words at the cops as they cuff him. And I was like, oh, the white privilege of it all. Because he would have got the shit knocked out of him probably if he was another person.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. Not all cops are bad. But I was just like, oh, you better shut up. You better shut up. You better shut up. But they're just gently place him in the back of a cop car where he solemnly sits as his voiceover tells us, I didn't blame Philip for leaving me, but I had to get him back. See, there's something I never told you about my old boyfriend, Jimmy. A long time ago, I made him a promise when I was waiting to go to prison the first time. We see a flashback, back, back, back of Jimmy looking extremely sick in a hospice bed while Stephen attempts to get him to drink some water. Stephen is emotional and pleads, you can't leave me. You're the love of my life. Jimmy's near death's door and has a soft smile on his face as he shushes him, saying, no, I'm not. I have seen him and you haven't met him yet. That's a horrible accent. Let me try it again. No.
Like, why you read my mind like that? Oh my gosh.
No, I'm not. I've seen him and you haven't met him yet. Stephen gives weak protests, but Jimmy continues undeterred. And you're going to be so happy. And I know you don't think so, but you deserve to be happy. A tearful Stephen blubbers. You're not thinking clearly. But Jimmy is, and he makes Stephen promise that he's going to treat this mystery man. He's going to take him, and he's going to treat him right.
Mm.
It's a heart-wrenching moment. But now we're back with Stephen in the cop car. One of the arresting officers brings Stephen a diabetic kit, thinking he needs it. But it's actually Philip who's diabetic. So what's going on? As Stephen's driven to jail, we realize he has more nefarious intentions with that little packet.
It just, this whole thing made me flash back to when when Philip is in the kitchen. He is opening Dub chocolates and eating them. And previously he was like, thanks for the chocolates, but I can't eat them. And he ended up using them to like trade for things, but in jail. But here he's opening Dove chocolates and he's reading the little messages that are like fortunes on there. And it's like,
mm-hmm.
like love is golden and stuff like that. And he's like, oh, this is cute. And he's putting it on the refrigerator. And I'm thinking, oh, I don't think that Philip is very happy because he's eating this chocolate and he knows like he shouldn't, because he's just kind of pounding it. And and so he, you know, he opens another chocolate, he eats it, he puts the message on the, and then he opens a third chocolate, he starts chewing it, and he looks at the wrapper and it says, love is like a sunflower on your face, or something like that. And he's like, what the fuck? He crumples the wrapper and then he spits out the chocolate he's chewing, like, get that fuck away from me. And I was like, yes, good job there. Go, Philip, go. Yeah.
That happened previously. Philip was not in his car escaping, eating Dove chocolates.
No.
But it does show that he was diabetic and said, caution be damned. Anyways. So Stephen takes Philip's little vials of insulin and injects himself with many, many doses, which results in him foaming at the mouth and seizing. The stunt lands him in the hospital, and when he comes to, he quickly, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, tries to escape, only to realize his ankle is cuffed to the bed. We cut to Stephen, fully recovered and getting booked into prison. He's sitting in a holding room with two other convicts when one turns to him and asks, what you in here for? Stephen never answers because he has slipped seamlessly into an elevator with a cleaning crew and is on his way down to freedom.
But freedom is very short-lived because the next thing we see, the elevator doors are opening and he is being brought back into the room with the police officers who say, we're going to put this guy directly into a holding cell, motherfucker. But his shenanigans aren't over. During his next court hearing, Stephen pays special attention to a bail request form that he sees in a clerk's basket. He memorizes it, and that night in his cell, he sketches it and sends it to a friend on the outside who types it up, all professional-like, and mails it back.
They check people's letters in prison and jails. I can't imagine that would get through okay. I think they would flag that and confiscate it.
Well, I would agree with you, but in the context of this movie, he explains to the new prisoner who he takes around and says, blowies are the trade for everything, and yes, you are going to be giving me a blowie now. He also says, they don't check letters, but they do. If you get any kind of treat or any kind of thing like that, then that'll get confiscated. So that's, yeah. So within the context of this movie world, whatever it is, yeah.
As somebody who has had relatives in jail, I know that not to be true.
Yeah.
Maybe things have changed between then and now. I don't know. But I was just like, that's a little hard to swallow there. Mm-hmm. Much like the blowjobs. Ha ha.
Although we are familiar with the California prison system and not the Texas prison system. So.
And the Texas prison system is right up there, tip top, top of the pile, as the most effective facilities in the nation.
Yeah. Completely progressive. So Stephen takes that non-confiscated form and signs all the right signatures. The next time he's in the courthouse, chained to 10 of his cellmates, he passes a court clerk who is walking by, and he pulls the forged form out of his pocket and throws it behind her while calling, excuse me, miss, you dropped something. It works. Stephen gets out, but is apprehended again. The whole time in and out of prison, he's trying to get in touch with Philip. But Philip's not taking Stephen's calls. Geez, I wonder why. One day, while at the prison phone banks, Stephen slams down the phone repeatedly in frustration. A nearby inmate waiting in line asks, how long are you in here for? Stephen, exasperated, replies, not long. Then hands the heavy phone receiver to the guy and asks, can you bash me in the nose with this? The guy looks confused, but must have obliged, because next, Stephen is in the prison infirmary with a broken nose. The attending physician is cleaning him up and doesn't notice that Stephen unclips the doctor's ID badge off of the front of his shirt and pockets it. Later in his cell, that motherfucker gets a bunch of green markers smuggled in, and while lights are out, Stephen breaks them in half in his toilet and dyes his white prison jumpsuit green. Then doctors it up so it looks like scrubs, and the following day walks right out the front prison gate. However, that stint of freedom is shorter than the last, because while the cops apprehend Stephen, he is still wearing the scrub disguise and is getting dragged out of a cheap motel.
And you know, if Steve had any time on the outside that was substantial, he'd be in a mansion or a condo or a posh hotel.
Yes. I'm surprised they didn't drag him out of a posh hotel. I'm surprised he did not find a way to con himself into a really nice room. Stephen's next escape plan comes when he's passing out sandwiches down the cell block. He notices a plainclothes vice officer wrap a walkie-talkie against the security door. A walkie-talkie against the security door. And the correctional officer manning the door barely looks up before buzzing the guy out. Steven smuggles a walkie-talkie from an officer's desk on one of his lunch deliveries and has civilian clothes snuck inside to him. However, the guy who obtained the clothes had limited choices. And now we are approaching the only spot in this movie where I laughed. And Steven is dismayed to see that he's going to attempt an escape wearing red polyester hot pants with black pleather pockets, a matching lava tank top, and heeled leather ankle boots. His disguise surprisingly works, and as Steven sashays out of the prison doors, the correctional officer chuckles and says, "Fucking vice man," to his colleague.
Steven's first order of business on the outside is to track down Philip and woo him back. Steven shows up to a small nondescript bungalow in a stretch limo and approaches the door holding a bottle of champagne. But he is only met with a shrill voice behind a closed door that directs, "Go away, Steven! What, you don't think I knew you were coming?" Steven implores for him to open up, but Philip is done and yells, "You opened up a bank account under the name of Dr. Morris, and now they think I'm in on everything. You fucked me over."
Mm-hmm.
Steven keeps pleading, and Philip keeps cursing, calling him a fucking liar. Finally, Steven gives one last heartfelt plea to say, "Just one thing, and I'll leave you alone." Philip apprehensively opens the door. Steven, full of hope, opens his mouth, but is interrupted by a flurry of police officers that have once again caught up to him. This time, he gets dragged to jail, and so does Philip. They're sitting side by side in silence, waiting to get booked. Steven tries telling Philip that he loves him, but Philip is older and wiser now. He lays into Steven about how he's a liar and has always lied, and how he was just as bad as all the other men in his life. Steven's eyes get moist as Philip states vindictively, "You were supposed to protect me. You did nothing but make a fool out of me, and you expect me to love you? How can I? I don't even know who you are, and I don't think you know who you are." Philip gets called up to be booked, but not before hissing, "I will never forgive you," before getting led away. Steven's voiceover admits, "And that is the last time I saw him."
I just want to say, one, Philip's little bungalow was so cute. And I was like, yes, I would live in that little cozy cottage. That was so cute. Two, motherfucker wrangled Philip in by putting a fucking bank account in his name. And I was like, Oh, you say you're looking out. Oh, you say you really care. Oh, you're going to go straight. And now you're involving your partner, the person who you say you love in this.
Yes.
Fuck off, Steven. Fuck off, Steven.
Steven had the good sense to leave Jimmy out of it so that when he got arrested, like, Jimmy was free and clear.
Yeah.
Just because he didn't know what was going on. But yeah, he literally did fuck over Philip, because now Philip is incriminated and now it's a felony. And now probably it was a misdemeanor the first time he was in jail, but now it up to a felony. And if it's like, that's his second strike or whatever. Like, he's just fucked.
Yes.
Then we see Steven getting booked back into jail, and his fresh heartbreak has got him reflecting on his life and choices. While making his way to his new cell, Steven's voiceover contemplates, "I've lied so much and so long I forgot who I was, and maybe Barbara Bascom had me pegged from the beginning, and that's why she gave me up." Steven cries in his cell alone, while his voiceover adds, "How does a person who doesn't exist go on existing?" The answer is, he doesn't. And we get another montage of Steven's most recent stint in jail, which includes him refusing to eat in the cafeteria, puking in his cell toilet, and losing half his body weight. He's nearly wasted away when he meets with the jail physician, who sadly informs Steven that he has a low T-cell count that indicates he has AIDS. Mm.
And we're back to Steven, emaciated, in a hospital bed. His voiceover tells us, "So that's where you, the viewer, met me." And I gotta say, okay, so while he's lying in this hospital bed, it's interesting because throughout the entire movie, his hair is like whatever. But in this hospital bed scene, for some reason, his hair is dyed jet black, and he has a portion of his forehead shaved, so his hairline is back a little farther, and it's just odd.
I heard something recently that might shed some light on that, because some people comment that when they go through chemotherapy, on the occasion, it changes their hair color. So somebody that had curly blonde hair after going through cancer treatments, which is not AIDS, now that I say it out loud, I realize that it's different.
I was like, that kills your immune system, and that is not what they would want to do for an AIDS patient.
Right. But maybe he heard that too, and that's why he was like, if I change my hair, it'll make it look more believable that I have AIDS. AIDS might also act as a type of chemotherapy of sorts and just change my facade. Or maybe he thought that it would be less likely that somebody somewhere would recognize him as that escapee Steven, place last name here. I forgot his last name.
Yeah, I don't know his last name. I don't even know if we mentioned it in this movie. But yes, yes, absolutely. So, I've been here in this bed for months waiting to die, but I don't know how much longer I can do this. We cut to Philip, who's sitting in his own prison cell, eating crackers, oblivious to Stephen's recent plight. Philip's friend Simon comes over and solemnly tells Philip that he has a friend who works in the infirmary who has a friend who found something out about Stephen. We don't hear the rest, but can imagine, because Philip tearfully races to the infirmary and demands answers. The prison physician tells him that Stephen fell into a coma and was transported somewhere else because it's just a matter of time. Were they in the same prison the whole time and just avoided each other? Tamara and I want to know. ? We are confused by this detail.
Yes. Because he can't potentially run to a separate prison and confront the physician at the prison that Stephen was in unless they're at the same prison. So maybe it was added for dramatic effect, but I was like, were they in the same prison this whole time?
The other thing that I considered, because you asked that question, which I think was a good question to ask, was maybe Stephen was in a higher security cell block since he motherfucking tries to leave wherever he is, so he needs more security. Thank you very much.
Yes, but it also seems like if that was the case, that Stephen would somehow find a way to contact or get in the same vicinity as Philip, because that is what he does.
Yeah. However, I would say that if I were sitting in prison in my beautiful lemon-colored jumpsuit that they had here, and I was getting notes sent to me from the fucking person who got me in jail in the first place. No, fuck off with yourself. No.
Note to self, dog mark this or earmark this. Corinne loves lemon yellow jumpsuits and potentially could pair that with a gold tiger belt buckle. That would be a look. That would be a whole look.
Yeah, particularly with my complexion. I think that the light lemon yellow would really add to it. Tamara's laughing because she knows. Ooh, that'd be bad. Bad, bad. Why don't I just go platinum blonde while I'm at it? Philip obviously still.
That hard damn word to say, isn't it?
There's so many syllables in it. I just can't quite get it out. Philip obviously still cares for... Oh, still cares for Philip.
See? I knew it. I knew I'd fuck up one time and there it is. At least one time. Actually, I thought it would be more rampant in this goddamn outline because, again, I don't know why those two names are so easily interchangeable.
I don't know why either, but yeah. At first I was like, well, it's because it's two men and it's not like the back and forth of a man-woman. But then I was like, no, because we did I Love You, Man, and we did not have a problem with the names.
Yes.
So anyways, he still cares for Stephen, but he's too late. We cut back to Stephen, who's still seemingly on death's door. He's reminiscing about his childhood as he watches kids play outside his hospice window. He's sallow and sweaty when a nurse comes in and hands him the phone, explaining gently, "Stephen, someone wants to speak to you. He's been calling nonstop, and he's driving us crazy." Stephen is so weak, the nurse has to hold the phone to his ear as Philip's voice gushes. "Stephen, why didn't you write to me? I don't know how this happened. They say I'm fine, but I had to speak to you. I'm still so angry at you, but I wanted to say I do know who you are, and I love you. I never stopped, and maybe we're just fools for love written in the stars or some crap, but It was never better or more real than with you. And even though you did all that crazy shit, I realize you did it for us. You're amazing, and you take my breath away. And even though I can't be with you right now, I'll always be yours. Now if you have to go, go. But know that I'm right there. Stephen's unresponsive head drops away from the phone, and we see Philip again sometime later. Simon comes into his cell, and when he doesn't say anything, drops his head in reverence and scurries away, Philip knows Stephen has passed. Wham, wham, wham. Wham, 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 wham.
See, that soundtrack works in so many ways in so many different parts of this movie. Why am I laughing, you ask? Well, Philip is still grieving a few days later when a guard gathers him, saying he has a visitor. He takes him to a private room, opens the door, explaining, "Your lawyer requested to see you." And sitting on the other side of the room is Stephen. Skinnier, but alive, and wearing an ill-fitting suit and tie.
That motherfucker! That motherfucker! That manipulative motherfucker! Okay. He waited. And waited and waited until fucking Philip called him.
Yeah.
Like, he was just like, I just gotta wait this out, and I gotta wait this out. Mm-hmm. I gotta have him think I'm dying. I gotta have him think I'm dying. Wait for him to call me. And until then, I'm just gonna lie here in this bed, thinking about days of yore and looking for penis clouds in the sky.
But it worked. See? It would have been the perfect ending if he just died. But he doesn't, Corinne. He's still alive. Now Philip's going to come rushing into his arms.
Uh-huh. It's fucking manipulative ass motherfucker. Ugh.
And I'm just kidding. He does not rush into his arms. Philip can barely maintain his composure as the guard closes the door. And once alone, it's only a moment before he slaps Stephen across the face, screaming, "You fucker!" Then we get a montage. Montage, montage, montage of how Stephen pulled off his most daring escape. His voiceover says, "Faking your death from AIDS is no easy task, believe me. But after watching Jimmy die, I knew what I had to do. First, starve yourself for 10 months. After that, you have to fake all sorts of symptoms." And we realized earlier the retching Stephen was doing in his cell was self-induced. His voiceover continues, "But the hardest thing is falsifying your records. However, everything has a price." We cut to an orderly who sneaks a fake diagnosis into Stephen's medical folder. Then, Stephen being told again the news that he has fake AIDS. But the process is now through his eyes, and instead of being morose about his diagnosis, Stephen is ecstatic because his con worked. His voiceover informs us, "Bureaucracy can only do so much because the hardest thing is getting transferred to a private care facility, which is standard procedure for late-stage AIDS patients. But in order to do that, I had to convince him that I was about to die." We see Stephen over time hoarding a handful of pills and then taking them all at once, which causes him to slip into a 4-day coma, which convinces the prison to send him to hospice care. Then we cut to Stephen commandeering a hospice phone to pose as a doctor who's looking for late-stage AIDS patients to volunteer for an experimental drug. "Do they have anyone that fits these required symptoms?" Stephen's voiceover says, "They did have one patient. Me. And for all the doctors, nurses, and tests, no one thought to give me an actual AIDS test. Fucking Texas." We see Stephen leaving hospice care to be transported to the experimental clinic, air quote, which does not exist. And once again, Stephen's free. And after all that hard work dying, do you know where he went?
To heaven. Wee, wee, wee. Wee, 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 wee. You know, if this man put that kind of effort into living a straight life that he did to getting out of prison and all this other bullshit, like, he actually, like, he could have been so insanely wealthy and well off without going to jail.
I know. I'm like, his self-assuredness and confidence just takes him places. And I just, yeah, I admire that, even though it's in the wrong direction for people, for law, for humanity's sake, because he's just probably a sociopath. But yeah, I completely agree with you.
Where we go? Response. What a fucker. And we do know because we're back at his slapping reunion with Philip. The two men are squared off, and again we hear Stephen say, "I just want to tell you one thing." Philip allows him to talk, and Stephen did all that fake work dying to tell Philip the words he never got to utter outside Philip's house. "I know you think I'm nothing but a liar, but underneath all those lies was something real. You said you don't know who I am, but I do. I'm not a lawyer." We know you're not a lawyer. "A CFO, a cop, none of those." Well, you were a cop, actually, but yeah, let's move on. "Or some kind of escape artist." Actually, you are an escape artist, Stephen. Stephen, you know what? Stephen needs to take a look at the man in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Those Stephens are done. And do we believe those Stephens are done? Do we believe those Stephens are done?
Uh-huh. Hell no. Unless we're very, very, very gullible.
Yes. And well, all that's left is the man who loves you. And if you can see that, believe it. Philip looks touched, but asks, "How do I know you're not bullshitting me again?" Stephen admits, "You don't." We cut to Stephen's next moves, where he does what he does best. He files paperwork for Philip's early release at the county clerk's office, but has the bad luck of using the courthouse facilities, and at the urinal, Stephen comes face to face with Larry, the motherfucking accountant who had him convicted of embezzlement. Oh, what a bastard. Or maybe you shouldn't have been embezzling in the first place, Stephen. Huh? Ever think of that? Larry's on jury duty, and who knows what would have become of Stephen if he never used that lavatory. I don't know why you're using the word lavatory, but you just wanted to hear me say lavatory. But
I did. Say it in a sexy voice.
Lavatory.
That's exactly why I put it in this outline. That's it, right there.
But as the camera pans back on Larry and Stephen peeing side by side, words flash across the screen that read, "On April 5th, 1998, Stephen Russell was arrested trying to secure Philip's release. An embarrassment to the state of Texas and Governor George Bush. Stephen was given an unprecedented life sentence." Coincidentally, the DA who prosecuted him was the sister-in-law of Dan Lindholm, Stephen's former boss, who actually should have been happy that he got all that extra money from making money off of the interest from the payments, that they were still paying the doctors like they should. Philip Morris was released in 2006. Stephen Russell remains in 23-hour-a-day lockdown with only 1 hour per day for supervised showers and exercise. The camera pans on a solitary Stephen who's got a far away look in his eyes because he's wee, 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 dreaming of Philip bathed in a beautiful glow, smiling at him warmly. And there's an empty prison yard just before sunrise, and a giddy Stephen is racing towards the fence with a dozen guards in hot pursuit. The camera pans up to a cloud penis, and we have the end.
Yes.
Oh. All right, Tamara. What did you think of I Love You, Philip Morris?
Oh, are we giving our dry kiss ratings now? Well, let me go through the ratings rundown. Do I give it one dry kiss, which means do not watch? Two dry kisses, which means if you only had three channels, you might watch it for a while before changing to an infomercial and then inadvertently buy yourselves knives. Then feel guilty, particularly when they don't cut a can as advertised. So many regrets. Three dry kisses, which would be yay! Would kiss this movie again. Four dry kisses, which would indicate that this movie is the date night you've been waiting for. Or five dry kisses, which means if this movie were life, you'd have gotten dressed by cute cartoon animals, some squirrels immaculately washed your dishes, and you rode to work on a unicorn. Corinne, I give this movie a solid, because I love it so much and I know you feel the same, four dry kisses.
That's very generous of you, Tam.
Yes, yes, I do. I always happen upon, well, not always. When I happen upon this movie, I watch it. I like being surprised and delighted. And even though Stephen was a fucking con man from hell that did not care enough for the people that he loved in his life. To be honest, when I first watched this movie, was like, oh my God, you're kidding. Oh my God, you're kidding. Oh my God, you're kidding. Like over and over and over again.
Which is funny too, because honesty is such an important part of relationships for you. I mean, I think it's an important thing for everyone, but it's like a real sticking point for you.
Which was also a surprise to me, because I'm like, obviously it doesn't bother me when it's somebody else getting lied to, apparently. I don't know. I also, again, I love the soundtrack to this stupid movie. I don't know what it is, but the strategic placement of the songs and music that they put, like, really spoke to me. And I was pleasantly surprised by Jim Carrey and Ewan McGregor's chemistry on screen. Mm-hmm. Like, I was just like, seriously, Jim Carrey's playing a gay con man that's in love with Ewan McGregor? Does that work? Yes, yes, it does. And even though Jim Carrey still has his kind of like out there antics in his acting, mm-hmm. it almost adds to the believability of Stephen Russell, just because you're like, what kind of guy would get away with all this bullshit? Like Jim Carrey, if he was that sort of person, but him playing it like just worked and spoke to me. Corinne, how many dry kisses do you give this movie?
With his Smarmy McSmarmington smile. Like, I'm like, oh, Jim Carrey with your Smarmy McSmarmington smile. Car salesman all the way. I give this movie 2.5 dry kisses. Because if I were watching it, I would watch it for a little while. And then I'd be like, this asshole is a horrible human being. I really have no interest in watching this because he repeatedly is a horrible human being, but it's supposed to be cute and charming, and I don't find it cute and charming. I find it to be really gross and reprehensible. So the movie did not work for me. However,
you know, I like reprehensible characters. It's just me.
I know. I know. You like unlikable characters.
Choice.
And so, like, it gets 2 dry kisses because I would watch it for a while. It's a legit good movie. I give it a half a dry kiss extra because it's a legit good movie. After that, yeah, it loses me and I switch the station and I end up, you are responsible for me buying Ginsu knives, Cam. It's all your fault. It's all your fault.
It also is just a little added flavor that this is a fucking true story.
Yeah.
So just watching this the whole way through. And incidentally, this was the story that we heard at the Obsessed Fest show that was done by Ellen and Joey. I vividly recall Ellen going, can you fucking believe this? He tries escaping again.
Yeah. And I think not. They put on such an amazing show. They're coming down to LA. And if it wasn't on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, but it's on a Tuesday, I would I would have like bought us tickets and like, you know, come down to see them. But but since it was on a Tuesday and the show's in the evening and Wednesday's my long shift at work, I was like, nope, can't do it. Womp, 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 womp.
Or breedy dee dee
dee dee. Yes. So with that, let's move on to the Four Musketeers of Diversity. How many musketeers are showing up to the table?
Body diversity.
No.
I mean, Cleavon was a substantial man.
Cleavon was a substantial man. He had a very brief role in this movie. Yes.
Right. And there was when Stephen was very emaciated. So there's that.
Yeah.
But overall, no. Very, very standard body sizes.
Yeah.
So no, I would say it may have poked his head in the room, but then quickly flitted away. So not a lot of body diversity. Sexual diversity, however, was present.
It was. I really wish they would have had at least one actor who was gay in one of those roles, though.
Right. Yeah. I agree.
Like, gay in real life, I would say. I'm not saying that straight people can't act gay, but, like, sometimes I would say that gay people can be limited in their roles because of, like, stupid prejudice and whatnot and end up not getting hired because of things to play straight. So it would have been nice to see a gay person in at least one of those roles.
Yes. Racial diversity. Jimmy was Latin. Clavon was black.
But Clavon had,
of the prisoners. Yeah,
Clavon had such a small part. Jimmy had a slightly larger part, but he wasn't there long either. So yeah, I would say like 10% racial diversity.
There was lots of racial diversity in the prison. Yay.
Like the in the background, characters. It's like in the Hallmark movies. Oh, look, you can see like a lots of rainbow of people. Yeah. No.
But is that even good representation if you're like, oh, yeah, all the ethnicities are in prison.
Yeah.
Yay.
So,
and there was not any disability representation. So
we've got like a leg of a musketeer showing up to the table after all is said and done.
Yes. A strong knee. Left knee, right knee, weenie representation. And now, of course, we are going to do our grab bag. Ooh. Categories, where we pick two random categories from the bag and discuss. And the first one that we get is the man in the mirror.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. And I used man in the mirror. How apt. Serendipity.
Who do you see yourself most in this movie, Corinne?
I guess I would say Steven's wife, but honestly, I would say who needs to really look at the man in the mirror are two people. One is fucking Steven, obviously, who we already sang about, and the other is beloved Philip Morris, who needs to get away from that man. Fortunately, prison took Stephen away from that man. I hope that Philip Morris found himself a beautiful sugar daddy who is taking care of him in a beautiful way and treating him with love and kindness.
I did want to say, like, I totally saw a lot of Debbie in you, Corinne, particularly when you get on your knees and pray for a half an hour before we get into your bed and spoon.
It's a little awkward, but you know.
Doll. I really think you could cut down the prayer time, much like Steven in this movie, but you know, it is what it is. This category is funny because even though you think Steven is reprehensible, like there's some parts of Steven that I see myself in, and there's some parts of Steven that I don't see myself in that I would like to, particularly the fact that he is so confident in just plowing forward to get what he wants. Like, I wish I was a little bit more like that in my own life.
Okay, I'm very interested in how you see yourself in Steven. Honestly, if I were to choose the two of us, who's more like Steven, it would be me. But
I'm saying, like, I wish I was more like Steven in that way, that how he plows forward and does what he wants, like, with such conviction.
Yeah, but you said there's parts of yourself that you see in Steven. What are those parts? I'm curious.
Maybe I should just take that back and say, I wish I was more like Steven because.
Okay.
And I do see myself in Philip Morris because I just want to blindly believe that the person that loves me is going to take care of me and do whatever's in his power to make me happy. And I'm just going to be like, great. I'm just going to be here and bask in it and enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm not really like Steven. I'm not, but I wish I was. So I'm going to take that out, please, Corinne.
I was just curious. I wasn't trying to call you out or anything.
No. I said it and then I'm like, yeah, no, actually I'm not. So, and then for the second category from our grab bag, we have, oh, this is a good one. Curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal.
Oh,
which can just be chanted throughout this whole damn movie.
Motherfucker. Sweet Jesus. He lives lie after lie after lie after lie and leaves a trail of people calling, curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal behind him, shaking their fists in the air. I'm talking about Steven, if anyone is confused about who I am talking about. Steven.
He would be less reprehensible, I think, throughout this movie if he didn't rope Philip into his last con or his second to last or his third to last con, or one of the last cons. Because then it was almost like he was kind of like sticking it to the man in a sense, like big corporations, because he was feigning injuries and committing insurance fraud, right, and, you know, basically stealing expensive watches from jewelry stores, yada, yada, yada. But it was never aimed at anybody he cared about except for that moment. And then there was a line in the sand where you're like, well, you're a dick now for doing that.
And he
did you have to? Probably not.
And he wasn't exploiting people who had less. He was exploiting people who had, or corporations, yeah, et cetera, that had more, which I agree that he was doing that. At least that was what was represented in the movie. Yes.
Yes. Even with his faux job as a CFO, like, yeah, he was still like, I'm helping you out, but I'm also helping myself out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's just that little like twist at the end where I was like, Steven, we wouldn't have cursed your sudden and inevitable betrayal nearly as much had, yeah, you just not did that.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah. Steven Russell definitely gets the Curse Your Sudden But Inevitable Betrayal Award, I think, for the year out of all of our movies.
Maybe even the decade. Okay, so what movie do we have coming up next week?
Next week, hopefully, we're doing I, Tonya, which has been a long time coming.
Whoop, whoop. The long-awaited I, Tonya. I'm so excited. I have never seen this movie, and I can't wait to see it. So thank you, Tamara, for bringing this movie into my life. Although I could have said the same thing about I Love You, Philip Morris, and I'm not. So so we will see. We will see if I will be ruining Tamara at the end of the day.
Yes, you will. And we are going to be joined by the lovely ladies of Histories and Mysteries Uncovered to go over the I, Tonya case, because, yes, they have a wonderful paranormal history and true crime podcast. So this movie layers in beautifully to their subject matter.
Because what's true crimier than a figure skating, potentially hiring a person to attack another figure skater so that they can go to the Olympics instead? Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
If you have anything you'd like to say about I Love You, Philip Morris, I, Tonya, or any of the I Love You movies that we've done recently, to death, you can reach out to us via email at onedrykiss@gmail.com or via Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at One Dry Kiss.
And that's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, if you have the time to rate and review us anywhere you listen to this podcast, we'd greatly appreciate it. But in the meantime, we'd like to thank you for stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one dry kiss. Mwah! See you next time.
See you next time. Eudora's infusion of cash. Steven, cash. Okay.
That's the story of my life, making this goddamn outline. I'm like, Steven, I mean, Philip, I mean, Steven, I mean, Philip, why do their names interchange so easily? I don't understand. Is something going on? Something you're not telling me? Because if there is, I want you to stop right now.
Burp.
I know I can't include that, but that is so funny the way you did that.